Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is John Meacham, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author whose books include the New York Times bestsellers Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, American Lion, Andrew Jackson and the White House, Franklin and Winston and the Destiny, and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. He's a distinguished visiting professor at Vanderbilt University, a contributing writer to the New York Times Book Review, and a fellow at the Society of American Historians. And his latest book just out is The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Meacham.
Thanks so much.
And it appears at the moment that President Trump is both at war with the truth and at war with the law. And his moves of late to basically contain the Mueller inquiry by ginning up this phony idea of a spy and infiltration of his campaign. And you can see that the drumbeat of that is going to get louder and louder. And then today, a couple of prominent Republican congressmen, Devin Nunes and Trey Gowdy of the Benghazi Committee, are literally looking into what Mueller is doing. They have unprecedented access to his work product, which is highly classified. And I expect that at some point or other that may well end up being leaked and perhaps manipulated, and it'll appear later on Fox News, if not be used in a potential defense for the president, who now knows what they might well have on him. So I guess this is a long-winded way to say that it seems like we are at a critical moment in this country where our democracy is under threat and that we could end up like Russia. So please tell me I'm not being too pessimistic here.
I think you're being a little too pessimistic. I think you're right to be concerned. I think you're right that it's a perilous moment in the life of the Republic. It is in its own way as serious, if not more so, than say the crises that shook us at the end of Vietnam into Watergate 40 years ago. And it is there's a crisis of faith in the system that has been a slow-moving but inexorable unfolding crisis since World War II in many ways, certainly since the Vietnam War. So you're right to be vigilant, to be concerned, to speak out. But my argument, ultimately, is that the system is resilient, the Constitution is resilient, and our country has been defined more often by strife than by smooth seas, if you will. And so I have every expectation that as long as the people are vigilant, as long as the press, broadly put, tries to report what's going on, as long as the courts do their job, as long as Congress at some point becomes a force for good, then we're going to be all right. But it's not guaranteed, and it requires an enormous amount of civic effort, which is essential but is dispiriting and exhausting, which is something I think the president is counting on, that by creating so much drama, he wears us all out. That's what we have to guard against.
But in terms of what appears to be almost an extinct species now, the moderate Republican, and you are very close to the former President George H.W. Bush, and you delivered a eulogy at the recent funeral for the former First Lady Barbara Bush. He's sort of an exemplary, I think, example of the moderate Republican that used to be. And when you contrast that to what's happening today on the Hill with Devin Nunes and Trey Gowdy, and they've deliberately excluded the Democrats. But at the last minute, they let in the Democrat Adam Schiff, but they also allowed Trump's new lawyer, Emmett Flood, to show up. So it leaves me to be sort of, on the one hand, feeling like the Democrats are kind of gutless and useless, and on the other hand, that today's Republicans are just sort of rabid. They're almost like junkyard dogs.
We're in a moment that is Hobbesian, right? I mean, it is the war of all against all. And I think to some extent this can be traced back to the Gingrich Revolution against George H.W. Bush in 1990-91, when President Bush raised some taxes in order to get a budget deal to introduce some fiscal discipline at a time when the deficits were seen as a threat to our broader global power. Gingrich opposed it. He led a revolution that ultimately produced a House majority for the first time in 40 years. And I think what a lot of Republicans, particularly on the House side, learned from that is warfare pays, and conflict is the best route to power. What someone like President Bush understood, what his son understood, it was that ultimately what matters most is what you do with that power. And that is a vanishingly rare understanding and vision of politics at the moment. But that ebbs and flows. There's nothing guaranteed about the success of the American experiment. And it's about not just the people who are in power, the people who are in office, but it's about all of us. And the fact that voter registration numbers among young people are rising, the fact that so many people are motivated by what they see as overreaching by the president, I think is a source of some hope. It's not a guarantee that everything's going to work out, but it does show that the opposition is vigorous, it's strong, and it's about 55% of the country. 45% or so of the country approves of what the president's doing. 55 or so does not. And the constitutional system protects the rights of the minority, but it also ultimately enables the majority will to prevail. And I think that's what we'll see. I certainly hope so.
Well, I'm sure that the Founding Fathers did not anticipate a kind of American Pravda, in effect. They didn't anticipate Rupert Murdoch and the idea that you could create an alternative reality which between 30% and 40% of Americans would be in.
With respect, they did anticipate that. Uh-huh. If you read the constitutional debates, if you climb inside the deliberations of the framers, they fully expected, because they didn't know what a neutral press was. Everybody was a Rupert Murdoch in the 18th century. Every right. newspaper, every publication was partisan and devoted to a particular interest. They did anticipate demagogues. They did anticipate that the populace would run, would be affected and buffeted by passion. It's one of the reasons for the complicated checks and balances, is they wanted to have enough symmetry, if you will, that it would at least prevent a particular faction from taking control for an overlong period of time. That's the entire structure of the Constitution. So I think they did anticipate this. I think they would have been surprised it took so long for it to become quite as bad as it has.
Well, that's, I guess, I was going to get to the point of how can the lone superpower function if there's no consensus about what is true and what is real. And, of course, back in the days of Uncle Walter Cronkite, there was some kind of consensus. I was very struck by the former Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who left this administration and presumably has some insight into it. At the commencement for VMI just a week or so ago, he said, an essential tenet of a free society, a free people, is access to the truth, a government structure and a societal understanding that freedom to seek the truth is very essential to freedom itself. If our leaders seek to conceal the truth, or we as people become accepting of alternative realities that are no longer grounded in facts, then we as American citizens are on a pathway to relinquishing our freedom. This is the life of non-democratic societies comprised of people who are not free to seek the truth. So if indeed, and I know that the early days, the yellow journalism was in fact journalism, but is there a relationship between my job as a journalist and my concerns about the truth being a moving target expressed by the former Secretary of State?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a perennial concern that people will respect facts. People will accept that there is a clinically accurate set of circumstances about which we can then form opinions. The problem you're putting your finger on, and that Secretary Tillerson talked about, is there is too few of us assent to a fact if it's inconvenient. So so we take an entire worldview. And, you know, as somebody joked, I wish I'd thought of the line, they hope that Hillary Clinton watches Fox News because it's the only place in America where she's president. So it does offer this alternative version of reality. And that was a concern, say, of Thomas Jefferson. He was always worried that that the country would return to a view of, in his world, hereditary authority, religious superstition. You know, the American Revolution is, at its core, the world's largest gamble in many ways on the capacity of reason to take a stand against passion in the arena. The revolution was a political manifestation of the European Enlightenment, the Scottish Moral Enlightenment, the Scientific Revolution, the Protestant Reformations, the translation of sacred scripture into the vernacular, an entire reorientation of the world from being seen as vertical, where popes and princes and prelates and kings told us what to believe, to a more horizontal understanding, where we could all be born with the capacity to determine our destiny. And that was based on reason as opposed to a blind acceptance of tradition or any singular worldview. And what I would urge American conservatives to do is, if you want to talk about original intent, that's the genuine original intent. Even before the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence is an assertion that reason, that the work of the mind and the disposition of the heart is just as important, if not more so, than a political gamble of a particular moment. And we have to be true to that.
So how do you steer the country away from this societal trend, both in terms of reality shopping, where people choose their own truth, and the earlier part of our conversation about the lack of civility and the polarization and the demonization in our politics? To some extent, I think it's also happens in our business schools. You know, they use phrases like take no prisoners and, you know, slash and burn. I wonder where that impulse comes from, that kind of militaristic impulse to win at all cost.
Well, it's a fundamental human impulse. It's what Hobbes was writing about, that the social contract was about moving away from a state of nature. And right now we're more often in a state of nature, you know, nasty, brutish, and short. It's just now it's nasty, brutish, and long. So this is one of the most fundamental conflicts, one of the most fundamental struggles in any society faces. And it's particularly acute at the moment for a variety of reasons, chiefly that a broad swath of the American public, largely white, largely working class, believes that the ladders of prosperity to a secure middle class existence no longer exist for them. And they blame upward and they blame around. They blame the elites, they blame globalists, they blame bankers, they blame people who are winning in this system. And they're also blaming people of color and immigrants and minorities who are on their way to being a plurality. We're not going to be a majority white country very long. And so this is an era where the politics of fear, the politics of pointing at people as opposed to pointing ahead, is prevalent. And my own sense is that the best way out of this is a historically based argument that convinces people, or at least attempts to convince people, that the best way to guarantee fair play for you is to guarantee fair play for the other guy. And that's what has made the country worth the struggle, worth the fight, worth the preservation. And the more we can remind people that we have always become stronger the wider we've opened our arms, then I think the better chance we have of getting them to listen to those better angels.
And in terms of no consensus on what's true and what's real, obviously that's also being exacerbated by new technology in terms of social media. Facebook, I think 2/3, 3/4 of Americans get their news from Facebook. And we know, of course, that was skillfully used by the Trump campaign. They caught Hillary Clinton flat-footed on that one. If that's a trend, both societally and driven by new technology, how do you reverse that trend, do you think?
I think you have to fight on that ground. I think that if you, I don't think there's really reversing it as much as now using it. And being in those, being on those platforms, being in that arena, vigilantly fact-checking, vigilantly pushing back against truly fake news. I mean, it's not a bad phrase. It's just applied to the wrong stuff. And that's the struggle. And, you know, we can't, you can't subcontract that battle. You can't outsource it. It requires everybody, and genuinely everybody. And I'm not trying to sound like the 4th of July or a graduation speech here, but we are at a moment because all of us have access to the same platforms, and anything any of us say can go around the world within seconds. We all have the means to, if you see something that seems fake, if you see something that seems wrong, say so. You know, push back right there in the best American tradition of being disputatious, and at least take a stand and say that if you're willing to believe something outlandish about an opponent, you know, if it seems outlandish, it probably is. And so I think that's the only genuine answer outside of a kind of censorship that I think is a slippery slope. You know, who should have the power to censor, you know, even if it, sometimes it deserves it.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, John Meacham.
Thanks so much.
And I've been speaking with John Meacham, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author whose books include New York Times bestsellers Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House, Franklin and Winston and the Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. He's a distinguished visiting professor at Vanderbilt University, a contributing writer to the New York Times Book Review, and a fellow at the Society of American Historians. And his latest book just out is The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Moss. I'd like to thank producer Grant Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Kathleen Ash and Alejandra Lariva Latt. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.